So as I said, to pass this course, you can have at most two absences. And if you have more, I will contact you individually and have a brief meeting with you to make sure that I feel better about passing grade here. There is a requirement that I have also introduced, not just presence, but there is a short project that you need to do. I'll send you email after this meeting. Essentially, what I want you to do is I want you to design an experiment, kind of discuss the things around the architecture of your experiment, of your choice, preferably for you, because for me it doesn't matter, and something that has to do with your dissertation. So essentially, I would like you to spend a little bit of time thinking about your research. So definitely every dissertation that I can imagine, except for maybe mathematics, will have an empirical component. You need to discuss, you need to show that what you are proposing, what you have done, is worth something. So you need to have some kind of evaluation section in your dissertation. It's going to be very difficult without it. So if you have an evaluation section, then the question is, what can you do in terms of empirical work? And you need to do something there. So describe it, just a few pages. I forgot how much I require you, but just a few pages. I'll send you that assignment after sometime today or tomorrow, probably today. I'll try to do it today, and give you a couple of weeks to do it so that you can think about it and write it. Okay, so... Yes. Oops, sorry. Great. What I'm planning today, there are two things. One is I promised to do a little bit talk more about data analysis using the causal discovery software. But I wonder how much I should spend on that. I did a little bit of playing with data, and I told you about some things that I do. I also told you that it's quite likely that you may find it useful in your work. Whenever you are collecting any data, looking at the data, you may want to analyze it. So it happened a few times, at least I think three times, that students who attended this class have actually met me with me later, and we looked at their data together, and then they did more with it. One case may end up in a publication, joint publication with the student's advisor, the student and I. There may be also a new doctoral student starting next year. He has to apply, of course, and be accepted, who will focus on the methodology also. If you want, we can spend a little bit of time on that. And then I have another thing that I want to talk about, and that is another way of doing science, doing empirical work that in computer science, typically they call it artificial societies. But it is really based on simulation, computer simulation. The idea is that with computers, suddenly new things are opening up, new methodologies for doing research. One methodology is what we talked about in the last two meetings, causal discovery based on data. Please know that without computers, it would be quite hard. Computers can do a lot of work, searching, trying to fit things, and it's computationally intensive. Artificial societies is another such new area that is just a few decades old and very, very exciting. I think this is one of those things that should lead to Nobel Prizes, because some of the research areas are economics. As you know, there are no Nobel Prizes in mathematics, computer science. There was no computer science when Nobel created Nobel Prizes. But there is one in economics, and I think some of the work being done using these methodologies is in economics, which gives us a good chance to for Nobel Prizes. But a lot has to happen. In science, things are not that fast. There is a book by, I think, Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Evolutions, Revolutions, I think, not evolutions, but revolutions, and he puts a bold statement there that the old generation has to die before something changes. So there are often new ideas, exciting ideas, but they are not accepted. People just don't want to look at it, they don't want to consider it. But when the old school dies out, literally dies out or retires, then the new methodologies are coming forward. I think this is one of those things that is already making into the mainstream, but before they get Nobel Prizes, I think we need a couple of more decades for that. So I think I have enough to actually cover the whole meeting today with artificial societies, so we can easily spend time on that. Do you have any questions about causal discovery, data analysis, building those graphs that we did last time? Well, if you have any data that you want to look at and you want to help with in the beginning, don't hesitate to contact me. I'll be happy to meet with you and look at your data. So let's talk about artificial societies then. This is, as I said, a new exciting way of doing science that pretty much was conceived in the 20th century, and a big kick is probably early 1990s. Today, a lot of work is done in this area. Why 1990s? I guess it's the power of computers, and of course, people actually doing this. So here is the outline that I want to do. Whatever I'm going to tell you about today is based on a book by two people, Joshua Epstein, which Americans pronounce it Epstein, and Robert Axel. Robert Axel is my friend. We were doctoral students together. Rob is, I know him as an excellent researcher. As a doctoral student, he was really doing a lot of complicated things in mathematics. He was doing research in economics. I think economics of the environment, pollutions, things like that, and building models consisting of equations. And that's a typical methodology in economics. You build models of things using equations. If you want to do it in dynamic, be indexed by time, you build systems of differential equations. Complicated models, quite insightful. But then he did something that I've never done myself in my career. Once he was done with his PhD, he was looking for a position, for a job. And then he was invited for a talk and then offered a position at Brookings Institution. It's one of those government-funded research places in the United States, close to Washington, D.C., close or in Washington, D.C., anyway, that area. And D.C. is District of Columbia. It's just a city, but separated from the state, Washington, D.C. And he accepted that offer because he found it so exciting that Joshua Epstein has convinced him that it's a good direction to go. So he did really a big turn from formal mathematics approaches. He suddenly turned into a completely different methodology. I've never done it. It's, of course, something like that requires a lot of courage. Maybe I didn't have the opportunity. When I saw this, that was actually tempting to also get into that area. But I was already 10 years into my field, and I thought, well, maybe I should explore more my work, my area. It's also an exciting area, but this was really revolutionary. I learned the details when I once visited Washington, D.C. I visited Rob. In fact, I stayed in his house It's always nicer than staying at a hotel. And we talked a lot about this, several hours, you know, over a glass of wine. So I heard about this from him. I read the book later. And I found it ingenious, actually quite brilliant. And interestingly, as I said, older generation has doubts. But when he gave this book, a manuscript of this book, to Herb Simon and asked him for a preface, Herb Simon immediately saw the greatness of this. So it's kind of interesting, you know, some people see the greatness, some not. I hope you will, I'll be able to convince you that this is really an exciting thing to do. So here are Epstein and Axel. Interestingly, Rob Axel grew up in a city in New York State called Warsaw, but he has no Polish ancestry. It's just the name of the city. I once visited it driving past. I even took a picture at the entrance to the small town, really. It's almost like a big village. So this is the couple that wrote the book, but Rob has, in the meantime, he has moved on. He's now a faculty member at George Mason University. I still am in touch with him. Sometimes, you know, good friendships, you don't need to see each other every year. I contacted him after like 10 years or so, and he is now collaborating with us on guiding a master's student doing some work related to agent-based modeling. Anyway, I'm going to try to spend some time on the motivation and the introduction. What is this about? They mention that in the book, a quote from Simon, who wrote in a position paper. A position paper doesn't offer a new piece of research, but offers a different view. And he wrote something that is that was a little bit revolutionary. We typically call mathematics, engineering, physics, hard sciences. And then sociology, psychology, you know, the soft sciences. Also in Polish, I think, we do that, don't we? Maybe there's not exactly soft and hard, but... And what is the other one? Humanistyczne. It's not. It doesn't sound as radical as in English. We say soft sciences. Well, hard sciences are the nauki ścisłe, and soft sciences are those that are humanistyczne in Polish. So he wrote that social sciences. So you see the humanistyczne. Not exactly the same meaning of the word, but social sciences are hard sciences, he wrote. The word hard has double meaning in English. It's hard, like the table, but it is also hard in the meaning difficult. Hard, something is hard, something is difficult. So he meant that it's difficult. They are actually difficult sciences because it's very hard to study things in those sciences. And don't make a mistake that this is limited to the social sciences, because you can do the type of things that we are going to talk about today in engineering very easily. I've seen people do work on like planning evacuation of buildings. It can be used in architecture. When you design a building, you can study, in case of a disaster, fire, how people will be exiting the building. So that can help you with designing exits, which is really very hard thing, civil engineering and architecture. In any case, social sciences are hard, difficult, because they're complex. Think about it. We are designing a bridge. Of course, it's a complex thing, but it's actually not that difficult. Nothing is disturbing us. We can actually draw the bridge, calculate the forces, and we are pretty much standing on a solid ground. When we are designing something in social sciences or studying human behavior, social behavior, we are studying the spread of a disease or a war, it's difficult because it can be so complicated. Things can go in any direction. There are many factors, many variables, etc. So it's hard. And there is no natural methodology for studying them. They are difficult to test hypotheses in those sciences. And the problem is that the populations that we study are highly heterogeneous. If you study something in economics, then every agent in economics, every one of us, is different, right? We have our preferences. Some of us prefer smoking, some of us don't like smoking. Some of us prefer sweet things, others don't. Some of us are vegetarians, some of us like money, others don't like money that much. We are so different. And there is really, it's difficult, because if you start using equations, how do you account for that diversity? I mean, true diversity, not the modern way of using the word diversity. Diversity is the way it's used in politics today. Politics and implication on social sciences, which are highly politicized today. Diversity is sexual orientation and races. That's diversity, which is kind of ridiculous because there are so many diversities. Once I had a meeting with one of the university officials at the University of Pittsburgh, and they talked about diversity and diversity. So I asked him, how do you get away talking about diversity and not inviting members of, let's say, Ku Klux Klan, so that you have diverse population? And he kind of wiggled out his answer, saying, well, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I wasn't insistent on the answer, but he essentially found ways of excluding certain population groups. So the diversity meaning in those terms, in politics and social sciences, is usually meaning diversity in terms of sexual preferences, which is kind of ridiculous because it's just one aspect of human life, and diversity in terms of race. In US, in Poland, we are pretty much uniform, so we don't have that problem. But the diversity in terms of sexual orientation is entering slowly but surely. Soon we will have censorship in Poland. You will not be able to say some things like, I can still say it, there's nothing that forbids me from saying that only women can get pregnant. If you say that, and I'm not joking, in a few months from now, a few years, when we have European Union, now Poland has given up it was extended to Europol that takes normally care of terrorism, financial things. There is a new category, the discrimination, hate crimes. What is a hate crime? Somebody defines it, and you can be sure that somebody who defines it is not somebody that you would like it to be defined. In any case, if we are following the footsteps of the Western Europe and United States, you can be assured that you will have a censorship. You cannot say some things. Anyway, diversity that I mean here is a real diversity that is relevant to economic behavior. Diversity of preferences, I mean preferences for things or not intimate preferences. So how do you do it? We don't have really a good way of doing this. And if you look at economics, then I don't know how many of you have taken an economics class. Have you taken any economics, anybody of you? If you haven't done it, I definitely advise you, because for me it was an eye-opening experience as an arrogant computer scientist, taking an economics class and learning about the approaches to economics. It's a fundamental science because it studies our decision-making behavior and the implications of that behavior. So what happens with the society when people do something, prefer something, or when you introduce a tax, or you raise or there's inflation, what happens? Very interesting theories that make sense generally, but from what I remember, it is really preoccupied with equilibrium situations. So here is what we have: demand and supply, two curves, they are crossing. the crossing is exactly the price, the equilibrium price. What if you introduce a tax? Oh, then, supply goes up, I think, or the demand goes down, whatever. There's a new equilibrium. And you can kind of make an argument that there is going to be a new price. There are interesting arguments saying, for example, that inflation is good. Because you can make, with inflation, your salary goes up and the price of goods goes up also. And then you can make an argument that is made in economics that consumers can actually be better off by adjusting their preferences a little bit. They are better off. Very interesting argument. If you take an economics, it's going to be interesting. And some of you may need economics, depending on what you're doing. If you're doing, for example, environmental work, some of you are probably doing work in the environment, then economics is probably very close. You want it. In any case, a difficult set of problems and difficult sciences. How can you do experiments? We talked about this. Very difficult to do experiments. Difficult practically or ethically. You don't do experiments in economics. In social sciences, just very, very hard and maybe unethical. The key problems there are, and also when you look at economics, is if individuals do something, what are the implications for the society? There are other questions, of course. If we introduce a tax, if we introduce the face masks during a pandemic, how will that impact the spread of the disease? These are all very good questions. Did we know the answers during the pandemic? I don't think we had good answers to that. What happens when you wear masks? People were making all kinds of arguments. If you wear masks, you will reduce the spread of the disease. But were the arguments strong? I don't think they were terribly strong. There were people who said it makes no difference. There were arguments about going to church. In fact, churches were closed in Poland for, I forgot, 1 month or so, 2 months. And then churches were reopened, but you had to wear a mask, etc. There were arguments about communion. In the Catholic Church, Orthodox churches also, they give you communion to your mouth or to your hand. Which is safer? All good questions. If individuals behave so that they want communion on the hand, what is the implication on human health? Good question. What do we do? So this kind of questions is what we do. And then we have a heterogeneous world, so people are very different. Some people wash their hands, some don't. When they don't wash their hands and take communion, maybe they can take viruses with that. The priests usually are taught very well to wash their hands before a mass, so I actually thought this was safer, but that's just a thought. No evidence for that. So what happens? How do we study that? In economics and in social sciences, the methodologies are usually based on equations, systems of equations that you write down, like supply and demand equation. Then you have a set of equations, and the solution is the equilibrium price. You need to make assumptions. If you make an equation in which there is a variable that says the price that you are willing to pay, or the price that you are willing to sell for, the company, the minimum price, the production cost, etc. You are assuming perfect information, so the agents know everything. They're perfectly informed. They have infinite computing capacity, and they maximize their utility. That's a foundation of economics. I may have told you that Herb Simon got Nobel Prize for questioning the foundations of economics. In economics, there is a fundamental assumption that humans maximize their utility, their satisfaction. So when you make your choices, you essentially try to maximize your satisfaction. Companies, firms, maximize their profits. So if you have a company, you try to make as much money as you can. That's an assumption. The implications of that assumption are that So let's say, any unmarried person here? Are you married?
No.
Well, if you want to be rational, according to the assumptions, you have to look at the world, 8 billion people. Out of that, roughly 4 billion are women. Out of that, many are children, many are much older than you, and there is a fraction of the women who are your age, suitable, potential. How many of them are there? I don't know. 200 million? Maybe 200 million, let's say. So if you are rational, what you should do is you should look at every one of those women, look at different aspects, like, you know, does she have a good heart? Is she nice? Is she pretty? What else? You know, there are certain things that are your personal preferences, of course. You want to look at all that. You should look at all these women and then pick one that will maximize your satisfaction. Those who are married now, how many of you have done it? You have. 200 million men? No. Well, you can. You can limit it. You can say, okay, I want a partner, I want a husband or wife who speaks my language, who is from the same culture. Well, that will limit it from 200 million maybe to 2 million. But still, if you want to look at every one of them, well, you have a long way to go. If I was following that recipe, I would be still looking. And I'm, ending my expected lifetime, right? I would be still looking. Completely impractical, and the assumption is just ridiculous. So by questioning that assumption, Herb Simon got Nobel Prize because he proposed a theory of satisficing instead of optimizing. In any case, the assumptions are just, the assumption is not very reasonable. And it doesn't even include the uniformity. People are assumed to be perfectly informed, maximizing, and then being uniform, having the same properties. And I bet I'm very different than you, and than you, and than you, and, you know, we are also different. And not only with the superficial things like the hair color or length, but also, you know, so many things that are much more important in us. So these methodologies, these approaches are not very suitable for studying things. These are the limitations. You essentially, the theories we have in mathematics are not very realistic. We have to say that. So now, what is the, ignores the time dynamics, what happens with time, because that requires differential equations, and that is harder, of course, and it's difficult. By the way, whenever I talked about static and dynamic systems with Herb Simon, he said, well, I talked about it once, and he said, well, in many situations, it's a much better idea to use static systems of equations, static models, than dynamics. He gave me an example of the Club of Rome. I don't know if you heard about this. You can find a Wikipedia article about it, probably. Club of Rome was a group of scientists somewhere in Europe, maybe also in the Americas, I don't know, maybe worldwide, I don't know the composition, but they essentially set out to perform the task of predicting the future, not from a crystal ball, but using mathematical methods. They put together a very complicated systems of differential equations involving time, that considered things like many things, humans, their reproduction, the environment, the clean air, the crop, the food, and everything. You know, really complex system of equations, a few hundred variables, few hundred equations. They solved it, of course. They needed computers for that. And they came up with a prediction. By the year 2010, or whatever that year was, the world will pretty much be starved to death because there was not going to be enough food for everybody. So they predicted a doom of the humankind. And as you know, they were not completely right about that. They did not consider many things like human flexibility. new technologies that allow us to produce more food, energy, and a lot of things that they did not predict into the future. So Herb told me then, well, you know, if you want to make this kind of predictions, sometimes a very simple model will do better, will predict better, because you can kind of look at current equilibrium, then you can put new values that you think will be there, and the new equilibrium will make a prediction. Probably that model would not be much more wrong than that complex system of equations. So even if you consider dynamics, it's not easy. There are problems with dynamic models. You may have heard about butterfly effect. You have that, yes? So sometimes small changes in the initial conditions have big implications. When you look at sometimes at simulation done by computers of dynamic systems, it's kind of it's scary because if you look at a system, there is some kind of, let's say, attractor, and then you shoot something in that area, and then it goes for a long, long time against along the same trajectory. It's not the same in my drawing, but it really looks the same. And then suddenly, further and further and further and further, and you know, goes away. That kind of is scary because we have seen the Earth going around the Sun for a long time. But who knows, actually? What do we know about this? Maybe one day, you know, something will happen that will make the dynamic system behave really funny. We don't know. And that is the effect of small things that we don't even notice, but they essentially can make this system unstable. So the new things that the methodology gives you, it studies the traditional disciplines like economics, trade, combat, cultural transmission, influence of cultures on one another. So all kinds of complicated things that are happening in human activities. And they based it on artificial society models. You couldn't do it without computers, even though the first steps are actually were done on paper. There is in a moment there will be a slide with some history of that. Everything is based on computers. The details will become clearer when you see that. The first attempts, it's really all 20th century where they use these kind of things when they studied things. Here is the history that I mentioned. Look, starting from middle of 20th century, really. I remember when I was still early 1980s, a student, it was in the Netherlands. Some friends were playing live, they called it live game, and they were also running a simulation on Unix, early version of Unix. No graphics, just axis and just axis. You know it? Yeah. You put this initial configuration, you run it, and then it changes into something. Expands or has some kind of equilibrium, collapses. Very interesting. I think that was based on von Neumann's work. But anyway, interesting mathematical problems. The history is long. But one thing I wanted to point out here in the context of science, sometimes science is ripe for things. Before that, before computers, we didn't have the tools to address those things. But once the computers appeared, we had the tool to build artificial intelligence and a tool to do simulations like this. Without computers, we couldn't do it. And that happens in every branch of science, really. Once I listened to lectures on calculus. Of course, the ancient Greeks were looking at some of the aspects, like the Zeno paradox, you know, the turtle that runs half of the remaining distance, and then half of the remaining distance, and kind of you can prove that it will never get to the end point, theoretically. So ancient Greeks were studying that. But the true revolution happened in 17th, 18th century, but 19th century was the absolute, a lot of developments, middle of the 19th century. Interestingly, you know, it became ripe. There were some tools like calculus, and people suddenly, there was an explosion of things. So that is typical for science. And if you look at this, the explosion happens at the end of 20th century when computers become sufficiently powerful. Hopefully not too chaotical slides that are telling more about the details. So they are based on agents, agent-based models. They are studying social processes. And the idea is that you define the individual agents and then observe what happens to derive conclusions about the group behavior of the society. So the only thing you do is you design the individual behavior. So you create artificial humans. It's almost like you have an aquarium with agents, fishes, but the nice thing is that you can define those fishes. Almost like playing God, you know. You are creating those individuals, and then you look what happens. You may think about God creating humans the way we are, and then looking, what are they up to, right? That's a way of looking at this. So we have, you create an environment in the computer. Typically, environment is two-dimensional. Like you create a field of 50 by 50, in early days, today, of course, it's 10,000 by 10,000, huge, because computers are more powerful. You drop agents into that field, and you give them rules of behavior. The nice thing is that you can create these agents modeling diversity. So if you are modeling economics, for example, you can create agents that have different consumption rates. Some people eat more, some people eat less. If you have a person who eats more, well, he needs to eat more, he needs to earn more, because otherwise he will die. Yes. Some people can see further than others, and that is modeling intelligence, in a way. Intelligent people, like you all are, can look further than people who are less intelligent. Less intelligent people are just concerned with today, tomorrow maybe. Smarter people are looking further. What happens with me 4 years from now when I have a PhD? Yes, that makes you plan. So people have different sides, different consumption rates. And whatever is relevant for the simulation, you can model that in the rules. And you are creating an artificial society in which you are dropping the agents and letting them interact with one another from bottom up. A long thing, we are not going to read it, but it describes, it's a quote from that book, you can read it on your own. I'm telling the important things here, so there's no need to read it. And then, if you have that, you can apply it to a variety of human social phenomena. Not only human, you can also do it with animals, with cars. You can model cars on the road. Give them rules. Suppose the cars are following the rules within the bounds of reason. Sometimes they violate the rules, like go faster. And then you can model what happens, the accidents, etc. You can model in the rules presence or absence of seat belts. You can model what happens when you hit, when you have an accident, probability of dying in an accident or having injury, and you can see what happens. Yes. So humans, animals, cars, what else? Countries. Whenever you have collection of items of individuals, so you can study trade. Trade is a very economics thing. Migration. That's also economics, sociology, group formation, also those social sciences, combat, wars, interaction with the environment, so you can model pollution, regrowth of natural goods, like wood that you need for burning, you can model agriculture, combat, environment, transmission of culture. What happens when you have immigrants in a country? Will they assimilate or not? What will happen with the cultures? Will they mix? Will there be a new culture? You define the rules and what you want to look at. A disease, so we can study things like COVID, spread of COVID. Population dynamics, will the number of people grow or not, depending on the rules. The agents are, well, people in quotes, because they can be, as I said, animals, cars, whatever, groups of agents. Agents have internal states. So an agent is like, you know, you can describe a human looking at relevant aspects. We can describe the need for the air, for food, for money, for whatever the important aspect is. We can have sexes, so we can have males, females. Only females can have children, metabolic rates, so how much they need to eat, vision. Vision is a metaphor for intelligence, I think. That's the way I see it. Some of the things can be changeable, so they can change over your lifetime. You can go on a diet, no problem with that. You can start eating less. You can become wiser over time. And some things are fixed, like sex is fixed. You cannot change it, really, physically. Health can change. Cultural identity can change. You can change your views, political views or social views, cultural views. Wealth, you can accumulate money. And each agent has behavioral rules, of course, relevant to the simulation, like mating rule. What is a mating rule? Well, I'm in my field, 10,000 by 10,000. I look around. If I see a female around me within, let's say, one or two steps, within my field of vision, the female is in the reproductive age, my age, well, I propose. I can be rejected if that female has a rule. She doesn't like me. I say no, right? Rules like that. If you have a suitable, if you pair, so if you, a metaphor of marriage, right, pairing, there's a probability you have offspring, you have children. But not necessarily, it's a probability. Some females cannot have children. Some males are impotent or infertile. So you can build all of that. You can make the population diverse. You can have a probability of getting pregnant, and it differs, right? So there will be individuals that are less likely and more likely to become pregnant, to have children. Health, the same thing. Vision, you can make it a distribution, so when you generate the individuals, they are going to be diverse naturally. And they move around and interact with each other. You see some examples of simulation. Here's a typical thing. They've done it so far in two dimensions, which is, I think, good enough, because even the surface of Earth, you can model in two dimensions. You can kind of flatten it and say, Białystok, let's say, it's a flat place. You ignore the hills, right? They're not necessary. And then when you have a flat surface, the agents can move in, let's say, four directions. They can take a step forward, backward, left, right. And they can see, they can have a vision also in the diagonal direction. So if they see something diagonally, they know they need to go right and up, for example. Here's an example, a rule of set of rules of behavior. Look far out as far as your vision permits, and vision is randomly assigned. And then if you see that there is food, they... In economics, they talk about guns and butter. I don't know why. Funny thing. When they talk about trading, they talk about guns and butter. That's what I remember. Why guns and butter? Beat me, I don't know. Here, they often, I've seen them talk about sugar and spice. It doesn't matter what it is. These are goods that you need. So sugar and spice. Let's say in a simple simulation, you talk about sugar. Sugar is in the environment. If you see there is sugar there, you go there. Essentially, because you need to eat it, and you have a consumption rate. You go in the direction where there's most sugar, that's a rule. If the greatest sugar appears on multiple sites, then select the nearest one. Yeah. You are lazy, By the way, animals are lazy. Fish are lazy. I fish. If you want to understand the behavior of the fish, you need to assume they are lazy. A trout will be next to the main current, but in a water that is quiet. He doesn't have to fight with the water. But if it sits the food in the current, will jump into the current, eat, and go back. Very simple rule of behavior. Move to this side, collect all the sugar at this position, and then, again, in the next iteration, apply the same rules. Environment, again, it depends on you, but very often they have they model natural resources like they are renewable. Sugar can regrow. You can eat all the sugar, and then in the next step, there is, again, a little bit more sugar. If you leave it alone, it will regrow to the original position, for example. What else? I guess you can make it separate from agents, or I mean it depends really on the problem. You are the god here. You can define what happens in this model. In terms of implementation, those of you who are computer scientists probably immediately see that object-oriented programming is very suitable to that, because you can design agents as objects. Probably most of you, those of you who do programming, know what object-oriented programming is. We have objects and methods. Objects are essentially like a collection of values, of the properties of the agents. And methods are the rules of behavior, right? You essentially use methods depending on what happens around you. Very suitable technology. It's a donut. Americans often call things donuts. It's in all the proverbs, you can't have a cake and eat it. You know the proverb. The Polish equivalent is Albo Janek. Do you know that? That's an old thing. An old friend of mine told me that. I didn't know what he meant, but he explained me. You either have intimate contacts with Janek, or you preserve your virginity. You have a Janek during your wedding, right? You can't have a cake and eat it. It's the American thing. You either eat the cake or keep it or have it. Donut. So here is an example from the book. So these are early days, remember. 50 by 50, this is the field where the agents are interacting. And you see the sugar. They have some islands of sugar. This is modeling essentially what we have on Earth. We have natural resources. We have areas where you can grow crop, and you have areas where you cannot grow anything. Like in the ancient times, we had civilizations around the Nile, Tigris and Euphrates. That was the Indus. There was even Indus River. I think it was maybe one of the oldest Indus Valley civilization. Then we had Sumer, and the old civilizations, precisely in areas that were fertile, where there were resources. So there is some distribution of resources. And when you throw agents on that, with the rules of behavior, move to the places where there is food, what will they do? Of course, they will start migrating to that, which will model that the old settlements and development of civilizations. So you throw them randomly, assuming that, okay, they are somewhere in the beginning, and see what happens. You see things like they are migrating to the places where there are resources, which is essentially explaining what happened in the history of humanity. And the size of the green, of the yellow dot is the amount of sugar. And then the rules to mating. As I mentioned, if you see a suitable mate, you mate. You may have offspring with that agent. You have a lifetime, so after some time you die. That's also natural. Combat. What is combat? You see somebody next to you with more sugar than you have. You feel that you can win. What you do is you start fighting. That's a very, very human thing too. Of course, a very primitive rule. But we observe that in primitive societies. those very lefty ideas, I think, in sociology, they are really... a friend of mine who has, I think, a daughter studying, or a friend studying those things, the assumptions that if you leave a primitive society untouched by the modern, spoiled ideas, they will be living in peace naturally. And any anthropologist who did field research sees that this is just garbage assumption. Humans naturally fight. The most primitive unspoiled societies fight. He told me about a tribe somewhere in Brazil, in the Amazon, untouched by the modern humans. You know what they fight for? If they have enough food, they fight for their women. They attack the neighboring tribe, kidnap all the women in the reproductive age, go back, you know, kill the males. This is a nice, unspoiled civilization. Some people assume that that humans are so nice and unspoiled when they are children. Wrong. If you leave children alone, if you don't show them the rules, teach them, keep them in control, they are little monsters. They can be little monsters. I'm sorry. Sorry for that. I should turn it off. So there are many examples of that too. So anyway, you can start it from scratch. If you have rules that the societies have actually certain rules of behavior dictated by the history, by things that they have developed, you can put them into memory, in the rules. You can do that. You are God here. So you can study very primitive, unspoiled civilizations. You can study whatever you want. And then agent environment rules, eating, eat the food and move to the next place. The technology, object-oriented languages, internal states are the objects and rules of behavior, the methods, that's the way that it's implemented. So here you have this field with islands of sugar, of the resource. You drop them randomly in the beginning. 50 by 50, that's the, mid-1990s. That's what the book has, but today you can do it easily. Hundreds by hundreds, or even thousands by thousands, really. Which makes it more realistic. If you have a bigger field, you can have more islands, or you have fewer islands, you can design it any way you want. So they decided how the sugar is located, and that does not change the qualitative conclusions, because if you look at the world, the resources are distributed in different places. So they have it in two places. The qualitative thing that they are looking for is how will the resource impact the behavior of the agents. So one of the things that you will observe is that the agents migrate to the resources, that just by the simple rules of behavior. And then when they model, the fundamental thing is, I think it was on one of the slides before, if an agent behaves this way, what is the implication on the society? It's a good question. We can study humans, their rules of behavior, their nature, and we can look at what does this imply in the society. We can do it the other way. We observe in the society, for example, over the wine, glass of wine, I told Rob, well, you can see what happens when people start marrying, getting married, which means essentially having a stable partner for their whole life. Because the rule of mating may be like, you see a nice female, well, you try to mate and then have an offspring, and then you see another nice female, you change the partner. But you can have a rule that if you find a partner, you just stick with the partner for the rest of your life. Rob said, well, actually, we want the society to develop stable partnerships. You see the difference, right? You have simple rules of behavior, and then the society over time develops stable relationships because they are essentially, naturally, in the process of development of the society, they are better for them than unstable partnerships like in some of the animals. Some of the animals, like, I don't know, deer do that, right? They mate, they find females and then mate with those females. Storks have stable relationships, I understand. They have the same pair, unless one of them dies, I don't know what happens then. Then they find another, or they remain single for the rest of their lives, I don't know. Anyway, they say that they have stable relationships, storks. Humans also have, in most societies that we know, naturally developed, we have stable relationships. We have one or another equivalent of marriage. I don't think we know examples in anthropology of the animal type of behavior. So the question is, what rules of behavior in humans are sufficient to develop marriage? Good question, right? What is it? Of course, you can have a rule, stay together, but what they want is they want to find a minimal condition that will lead to stable relationships. Good question. So you see, you are looking for minimal rules that are explaining phenomena that we observe in the world. What do we observe in the world? Well, migration to places that are fertile, that are richer. We observe wars. We observe migration. You see some of the simulations. So the question is, what rules of behavior are sufficient to reproduce that? And that's a good thing, because we have an explanation for the phenomena that we observe in the world. So we are learning, again, the truth. We are learning the world, like the things we did in this class, but using a different methodology. So wide range of phenomena can be observed. Carrying capacity. You know what it is, carrying capacity. That is essentially, you cannot have more than a number of animals, let's say, at a given area. Let's say we have wolves in Białowieża Forest, which is the largest wild forest in Poland. We observe that a stable population of wolves is whatever, around 80 individuals. If you have more, then some of them will start dying out because there's not enough food for them. Yes? If you have less, then the prey will raise. There are going to be more rabbits or more deer, and the number of wolves will again grow up to 80. Very interesting thing that is observed in biology. So the question is of carrying capacity. If we have a model like this, we have the sugar, how many individuals can we have? Or is there always a maximum number that we have? You can observe it. Migration, you see simulations, which is very, very kind of nice to look at. Another thing that is a phenomenon that we know, we've known it for centuries, uneven wealth distribution. Most of the theories that I think is in the lefties, I mean the left-wing people, is this ideal that we should distribute the wealth equally among everybody. If you look at societies that are completely left alone, right? No rules like that, that I'm taking away from you because you have too much, you know, give it to him because he has too little, then you will observe enormous inequality of wealth. In fact, I think the wealth is distributed following a distribution that is known as ZIP distribution. ZIP distribution is, you know, something like this. This is the number of dollars wealth, essentially. We observe that most of the people have very little. Then there is some people in the middle, but then, you know, there is a handful of people who have most of the wealth in their pocket. In US especially, it's so asymmetric. I forgot the numbers, but it's like 2% of all Americans hold 95% of all the wealth. And that is a phenomenon that we observe in every society. If we leave it alone. So now the question is, can you reproduce that? Yes, you can, with very simple rules of behavior. Very simple rules. So if you leave it alone, if you let people just make choices, make trades, then you will observe that. So different scenarios, I'll show you some of them, so no need to stop here. Let's maybe look at the scenario, so that because otherwise it's going to be boring. The rest of the presentation is really the different scenarios. We have a handful of simulation, and I forgot which one is which. Oh boy, that's going to be difficult. This may be the simple one. So when we run it, essentially what happens, you know, you have terrarium, you throw the agents and let them behave. What you see is different iterations. And in fact, the movie shows you once every few iterations, because otherwise it would take too long. So you start with a random assignment of a location. Look what happens after some cycles. People start living in those fertile regions. But some people live here. What does it mean? Well, they've enough to eat. They have low metabolism. They don't feel the need to move. They have enough, essentially. We observe that too. We observe some small villages somewhere, small societies somewhere in the jungle. They don't need to migrate. They are self-sufficient. Again, look at that. In the beginning, random, and then just following the simple rules, this is the way the society behaves. So we are looking for qualitative conclusions, like there will be uneven location of individuals in the society. They will tend to settle where there are resources. So exactly what I said, the ancient Egyptian civilization, for example, was around the Nile, especially the delta of the Nile, which was very fertile soil. You could plant a crop several times a year. There was enough food there. So this was a simple scenario. Let's look at a few, and then we'll come back to the slides to kind of recognize them. Where is the wealth distribution? I think this may be the one. I should title them. You can find those movies on the web. You can find the software in the repositories. You can, in fact, start developing those simulations further. Now look at that. These are this is wealth, I think. As the simulation progresses, the distribution will change. Here is an interesting thing. When you have mating, so you have males and females, and they produce offspring, the offspring genetically inherits from the parents. That's a simple rule. We know it. You have two smart parents, you have smart children also, kind of genetically, right? They are born with better hardware. So your children will be probably smarter than average, assuming that your husband, your wife, is as smart as you, they're going to be smarter. And that is essentially reflected here. Here is the development of vision as time goes. Please note that the society that develops has overall higher vision than the society in the beginning. Why is that? And another thing is the metabolism. If you look at, it's hardly visible. The metabolism is going down. Well, why is that? Because as you go, the people who need to eat a lot, they will die out. They don't have enough food. People who eat less, who are smarter in finding the food, will have over time lower metabolism, their offspring. Because those who have lower metabolism are more likely to survive, their offspring will inherit that. Interestingly, I recently have started looking at my ancestry. I've gone as far as the middle of 18th century. And one of the things I observed is that my ancestors, and I think it's a common thing, living in a village somewhere in central Poland, they had typically 8 or 10 children. Kind of, you know, I haven't measured, but that's a typical thing. And of those 8 or 10 children, half of them died as baby infants or having a few years old. Probably different reasons, you know. Any infection, bacterial infection, there were no antibiotics. They often led to death. Lung infection, the pneumonia, that was a deadly disease. Many other diseases were deadly. People also, many were dying young, like in their 30s, 40s. Towards the end of 19th century, early 20th, I see people living like 70 or 70-something, but they were belonging to exceptions, really. Typical lifetime was 60-something. I got upset at some point. I found an ancestor, and there was, in some of the records, there's a cause of death. She was 69, and the cause of death was old age. It was upsetting because I'm going to be 67 this year. Now we tend to live longer. But why am I telling that? The people who were dying, they were weaker individuals. So the society overall became stronger because of that. That's sad, of course. You know, these were people dying. But the side effect of that was that those who survived were stronger. In the animal world, the same happens. If you intervene, you are screwing around with that. There are voices, for example, again, I told you I like fishing. In Alaska, they introduce salmon artificially, in the sense of taking the eggs, the sperm, fertilizing that in big buckets, then letting them into pools where they grow until, they call it fingerlings, and then they let fingerlings loose in the waters in the spring, which is pretty much what they would be in the wild waters, in the rivers, because salmon spawns in the rivers. And then they migrate to the ocean, come back as adult salmon when you can fish for them. In any case, the voices are that the population of salmon is weaker genetically. They are not as strong as the white salmon that was initially. Why? Because they are protected from the egg to fingerling. And in nature, those the weakest would be eaten by something when they were that small. Right? Typically eaten or they would die. Interesting phenomenon. I don't think this is wealth, because there's another simulation where the wealth becomes very very asymmetric. So let's go to the next simulation. How do I go back? I think this one. These are just, who knows, maybe this is the wealth simulation or not. We start from a random assignment. Okay, this is actually a movie recording the software. Probably you can find the source code for the software in a repository. This is doing what? A wealth distribution, metabolism, and vision. So it's similar simulation, but with the whole interface. The interesting thing is, these, you see the waves. You see that in migration. What happens is the first wave of people move, eat everything, and the next wave finds it unattractive, so they wait until it regrows. When it regrows, they say, oh, how nice, so much sugar. There's a next wave. So probably this is the reason why there are the breaks in between. Look at that. The population, it's not going to the end. And I don't think it's modeling the wealth distribution that is observed in nature, because in nature we see much more asymmetry in the distribution. That's the end of the simulation. So, but again, metabolism goes down. That's just evolution. The strongest or the eating least individuals survive. The ones who see further, smarter, they also survive. Let's look at, did we look at this? Maybe not. Let's see what this is doing. Wealth distribution. Gini index is measuring the distance between things, but I don't know what exactly it is. In any case, you see again a simulation in which we, at every cycle, we plot, okay, here is this typical thing that you see in society, is the wealth distribution. So again, the game is to show that a given set of rules is sufficient to produce something in the society. So you can actually answer the questions, what kind of conditions can lead to something? When you study disease, you can say what kind of things are sufficient for the population to be, you know, to die out or to get sick. Or if you model resistance, you know, what kind of population, what will happen when there's pandemic? Anyway, typical, you see, typical wealth distribution that we see in nature. You can even model that, compare it to the wealth distribution observed in some societies. Let's look at this one, because there are interesting simulations here. This is looking at there is trade involved, because they have two goods, sugar and spice. A rule is simple. If you need both to live optimally, you need to eat both. And then if you see an agent who has more spice and you have too much sugar, they have too much spice, you trade. And then they can study also things like equilibrium price. This is the carrying capacity, number of agents over time. You see, there were 400 dropped. Here is the carrying capacity of the environment, given that they can trade. If you don't have enough sugar, you have too much spice, you may die because you need both, and vice versa. So these are simple simulations, but there is migration, which looks really cool. Maybe this is the one, let's see. Maybe this is migration, that's what I want. Look at that. We have two islands of resources. We started with all the agents being here. And as time goes, agents move to this location too. And the interesting thing is that they are going in waves. Migration goes in waves. It can be probably explained, you know, that the first wave that goes eats the resources, then the next, the remaining agents don't see anything attractive, but when it regrows, they go in the next wave. Again, carrying capacity with migration. Histogram that of things that you can look at. Truty, I don't know what it is. Tax, I don't know what it is really. Again, the phenomenon of evolution. See what this is. Again, this phenomenon of carrying capacity of the environment is always some asymptotic value. I don't know what this is, I'm sorry. There was some rule that made them stay at the edges. I don't know what that is. We've seen everything here. So this was the simple scenario. Find food and eat it. Sexual reproduction. So again, these are the males and females. I don't know which one is which, but you have rules that tell you if you find a person of the opposite sex, you consider mating and then having offspring. And things that are being seen. That sounds chaotic and kind of, you know, almost random conclusions. But keep in mind that very often they start with a phenomenon that is of interest to science, like assimilation or carrying capacity or equilibrium price, and then they try to find minimal set of rules that will reproduce that. And that's an interesting question. What is it that is sufficient to reproduce something? Of course, you could have completely wild artificial rules, but they are trying to enter rules that are very admissible, very reasonable, rules of behavior that we see in humans. And what is the minimum said that it is capable of reproducing. Combat, the rules are like, I'm able to win, that's why I'm fighting. Avoid revenge. And the observation that they made is localized war. So what we see in the society is war here and there, local conflicts. Trading, so food and spice, you've seen some of the simulations of that. You need both to live, to eat healthy, and then there is trade, there is local price, and then by allowing trade, they observe that there is an increased capacity of the environment, which is interesting. When you can trade, that's what the economics have been telling, trade is beneficial. They can actually show it. Social inequality, the wealth distribution is also asymmetric. They also, in simulations, they also did things like derive the supply and demand curves. And you can see them actually moving. Supply and demand curves depend on the local price, asking price, paid price, and you can show the global equilibrium price. Second consumable, you need that to trade. And they differ, of course, the agents. They have different preferences. Trading takes place locally between two agents. There are no clearing houses or brokerages. And you can look at supply and demand. Of course, you can start playing with the government intervening, like having brokerage house. You can do anything here. You have under full control. Credit networks. If you don't have enough money and you need it, and you see an agent with money, you borrow. With interest, of course. It's up to you how to set the rules. If you don't have a way to pay, you can have a rule that you die or you become a slave or whatever societies are doing. A loan, due date, negotiated price, the rule you want to raise children. Observation. People start specializing in being lender and borrower. Something that, wow, it's interesting. Something that we observe in societies. Carrying capacity. You've seen that in many simulations, that usually most simulations ended up having a number of agents, a given number of agents. Depending on the vision, the initial average from which you sample. If you have initial vision of one, then carrying capacity is higher. That's kind of funny. If you have agents seeing further, the carrying capacity is lower. What does it say us? Tell us? You can accommodate smaller number of smart people than when the people are less smart, I guess that would be the conclusion. Natural selection, which is the evolution, selection of metabolism is going down. Vision goes up. Wealth distribution as time goes, they observe this asymmetric distribution. In the beginning, you give everybody randomly some wealth. But as time goes, you observe asymmetry. And it just follows from simple rules of behavior like trading and whatever, borrowing, lending. Migration, you saw those waves. That as time goes, there is a wave of migrants, then a little bit nothing, and then another wave. And we don't talk here about, I guess, in human societies, we don't talk about days, weeks, or months. We talk about maybe centuries. There is a migration wave going. Some people say that Rome suffered from migration of individuals, that Rome fell because everybody wanted to go to Rome when Rome was the center of the world, and there were many, many migrants that changed essentially the culture of that whole empire. Sorry. They made an observation of waves of migration. Another thing, seasonal migration, like birds. We know birds are migrating to the north for food, to eat insects, south to eat something else, like storks. There are also interesting observations of individuals develop into being migrators and hibernators. Interesting thing, isn't it? Some animals decide to sleep, like bear. Some animals start flying to better things. Low metabolism, low vision turn into hibernators. And there's specializations. So here I think the individuals are similar, but just the properties, high vision, low vision, high metabolism, low metabolism. Pollution, another thing, what happens? I don't know the conclusions, I don't remember, and I haven't read the book in that much detail, but there are also certain conclusions, like where people settle. First the food, but then they abandon the polluted zone, go into a more quiet place. Many die of starvation, there's diffusion of pollution. Different ways of defining neighborhood in the simulations, social networks, let's see if there's anything interesting. Spread of messages, right? Spread of infections, that is going to be another slide on diseases. You can model that too. How gossip spreads. Right? Disease. You have individuals who are sick, who are healthy, and how the disease spreads. Where and how quickly. You can model also number of people diseased over time. And compare that to the observed values, which we have. We have a history of the COVID infection, for example. Some links, I haven't checked them recently, so hope they work. But you can find for sure on SourceForge, you can find code for this kind of simulations if you are interested. Very difficult in our doctoral school to change the topic of the dissertation, as you know. So you cannot change it. But who knows, maybe in some of your work you'll find it interesting. Or you'll change your interests after getting the doctoral dissertation. Very exciting type of work that I really think will lead to Nobel Prizes in traditional disciplines like economics, because they will be able to explain phenomena that we observe in economics or sociology or epidemiology, and pinpoint what exactly is underlying different phenomena. It sounds kind of funny when you are looking for the minimum set of rules, but look, we are looking at the minimum set of rules among the rules of behavior that we know exist. Right? We know how the disease spreads, the distance from the diseased individual, and we are this is a rule, a local rule. Is this enough? Is this enough to cause something, to cause a wave of infections? Very good. So that's all I wanted to say about this. Again, the purpose was just to show you another way of doing research that I think is very exciting. This is also empirical research, even though it's all done in a computer, not by measuring things. Just like causal discovery is done by measuring things and then studying the data. There are other things done by computer too, but they are more traditional. You can test hypotheses by simulation. Simulation is just amazing. It's statistics in action. You can perform... you can essentially reproduce things by means of simulation reliably, really reliably. It's almost like building a bridge instead of building a real bridge, building a model of a bridge. If there's anybody studying architecture, you know you sometimes build a model of the bridge to see what happens. If you put pressure, stress, will it break or not? Good. That's the end of it. My time is up. As I said, I will get in touch with you individually. There are not so many of you who have more than two absences. In many cases, they are absolutely justified. So actually, we have just three people who are potentially... Mehmet showed up here, so you have very few absences. I'll get in touch with you and do some kind of maybe an online meeting to make me feel better, forgiving you that. very good. And then I will send you also the assignment and give you a generous time, maybe a couple of weeks. Once you send it back, I'll check it, send you feedback also. Try to treat it so that it's useful for you. Do a design that is useful for your own work. By the way, this is, I think, from last year. It's not... I think it's last year, not this year. Is it? I think it is. Good. So, thank you very much, and you will hear from me.